Hello, and welcome to On Science. I'm science desk intern Megan Voss. This week, we have evolution and oil. Not a typical combination, but both go back millions of years. So let's run with it. We'll have a study that has mapped the oil spill in the Gulf, as well as a new tool scientists can use to measure the damage. But let's start with two stories which aired this week in our series on human evolution, The Human Edge. Have you ever wondered where words come from? Sure, you can take a word like radio and trace it back to the Latin word radiationum. That still doesn't explain how we came to make sounds like the word radio, or give them meaning. It's fairly easy to see why language gave our ancestors a big evolutionary leg up. But as NPR's John Hamilton reports, researchers can only guess where it came from.
Ask Jeff Ellman why language is such a big deal, and you get a simple answer.
Because it's changed the face of the Earth. I mean, the Earth would not be the way it is if humankind didn't have the ability to communicate, to organize itself, to pass knowledge down from generation to generation. We'd be living in troops of very smart baboons.
Ellman, a cognitive scientist at the University of California, San Diego, says language lets us cooperate in groups of millions instead of dozens. It also lets us share the complex ideas produced by our brains. And it's flexible in ways you don't find in the communication systems of other species. Take bees. Ellman says they have a remarkable ability to communicate precisely where to find pollen.
It's a very elaborate system. It works very well. But that's all it does. So they can't talk about politics. They can't talk about, you know, who's having an affair with what other bee. And these are things that we can do.
There's no single language module in our brain. Instead, language seems to come from lots of different circuits. And many of those circuits also exist in other species. Some birds can imitate human speech. Some monkeys use specific calls to tell one another whether a predator is a leopard, a snake, or an eagle. And Ellman says dogs read our gestures and tone of voice.
You could take a little bit from a dog, a little bit from a monkey, a little bit from a parrot, and a half a dozen other species, and you put it together, and what you get is exactly the right ingredients for, you know, making language possible.
What's unclear is how and when language first appeared. David Armstrong spent decades pondering that question at Gallaudet University. He says the problem is that unlike physical changes, mental ones don't leave behind any fossils.
We have no way of knowing exactly when or how people began to speak, or in the case of sign language, when they began to sign or to gesture in a way that was complex enough for us to consider it to have been language.
Language means not having just a label for, say, an axe, but being able to convey an idea, like, the axe works better if you hold it this way. And there are several competing hypotheses about how language emerged.
Gesture, visible gesture, especially gesture involving the hands, may very well have been the earliest form of complex human communication.
Armstrong says evidence from fossils supports that idea.
Relatively early on, we see the modern human hand pretty much in its current configuration.
That was a couple of million years ago, not long after our ape-like ancestors stopped walking on their knuckles. But things like the modern vocal tract seem to have arrived much later. And the modern version of a gene called FOXP2, which is important for speech and language, didn't appear until perhaps 100,000 years ago. So Armstrong says early human ancestors probably used gestures to communicate.
Articulate speech of the sort that we employ would have been probably difficult for these animals.
Also, Armstrong says, some kind of sign language would have suited the early human lifestyle.
Clearly, one of the times that visual signing is advantageous, and especially to, say, hunter-gatherers, is when they're hunting. And you find sign systems that are used by hunter-gatherers to communicate about their collective activity, to communicate about the sort of animal that they might be pursuing.
Without making sounds that could alert their prey. Armstrong thinks these gestures eventually became associated with sounds which got more sophisticated as the human vocal tract evolved. Even now, there are close links between the brain centers involved in speech and those involved in sign language. Of course, once spoken language appeared, Armstrong says, it would have given our ancestors a huge advantage. You no longer had to put down your tools or your baby in order to communicate. And then, of course,
up until the invention of the incandescent light bulb, people spent about half their time in the dark.
Another idea about the origin of language is that it came from song.
C-D-E-F-G-H-I-J-K-L.
Ani Patel of the Neurosciences Institute in San Diego says that idea just feels right to a lot of people.
We feel music just taps into this kind of precognitive, archaic part of ourselves that reaches so deep inside us that must have come first and be there before we had this complicated articulate language that we use to do abstract thinking.
Patel says even Charles Darwin thought language might have had its roots in musical expression.
He talked about our ancestors, both males and females, singing songs, love songs to each other, essentially, without words, before we could speak articulate language.
And just like with language, you can see aspects of musical ability in other species. Some monkeys can recognize dissonant chords. Songbirds use complicated patterns of pitch and rhythm. A few parrots can even dance to a beat. What's more, modern humans still combine music and speech in ways that seem innate. For example, when a parent speaks to a baby.
It's this kind of lilting intonation. Aren't you a cute little guy? And, you know, they slow down. There's a lot of rhythm, a lot of exaggerated pitch contours. And people have speculated that this kind of way of communicating with infants might have been one of the important roots to language in our species.
Patel says it's also worth noting that the brain processes music and language in a similar fashion. But he says just finding a connection between music and language doesn't prove that music came first. Patel himself favors an explanation of the origin of language that doesn't start with gesture or music. Instead, it comes from a behavior you see in another smart mammal with a very long lifespan.
Killer whales have dialects where different pods have different characteristic calls that seem to be important in establishing identity. And our ancestors living in small groups where affiliation and identity was important, it seems interesting to think about them having some kind of vocalizations that could have helped them identify each other.
Patel says that over time, these social calls could have become words, a bit like the ones you're hearing right now. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Language isn't the only thing that helped us on the road to humanness. So did other things like curiosity, fairness, even our ability to be playful. And it's not quite so difficult to see how we developed those qualities. To find out more, NPR's Joe Palca spent some time hanging around with monkeys.
Humans catch on to fairness at an early age. I demonstrated this in 2003 with the help of two young boys, Sam, who was 9 at the time, and his brother Jacob, who was 6. The demonstration began with two piles of books on the kitchen table.
Jacob, you see this pile of books here?
Mm-hmm.
If you take these books upstairs and put them in your bookshelf, I'll give you $1, okay?
Okay.
In a few moments, Jacob was back in the kitchen.
Give me $1.
Here's your dollar.
Thank you.
Now, Sam,
yeah.
If you take those books up to your bookcase, I'll give you 50 cents.
No way.
No way indeed. Kids clearly get the concept of equal pay for equal work. Psychologist Sarah Brosnan argues that traits like fairness and curiosity are essential for social creatures to survive and live together. But where did these traits come from? Brosnan is trying to find out.
Let me see, who do we have out here? This one's Wilma, and she's got a little boy, Widget, running around in here somewhere.
Wilma and Widget are capuchin monkeys. They're outdoors in a caged enclosure at the Language Research Center, a part of Georgia State University.
So the nice thing about testing these guys is they're living in a normal social environment. So they spend the vast majority of their day out here running around playing together, and then we just separate them out for the testing.
The monkeys climb over branches in the cage, swing from the top of the cage, wrestle with each other. When it's time for testing, they go indoors.
Ready, Liam?
Brosnan's graduate student, Audrey Parrish, is testing two capuchins, Liam and Logan. The test tries to get at the concept of fairness in capuchins. Here's how it works. Audrey hands Liam a granite token, and he hands it back to get a food reward. Not too tricky. Audrey alternates between Liam and Logan. Now, here's the twist. Sometimes each monkey gets the same reward, and there are two kinds of rewards. A scrumptious, extremely desirable grape, or a ho-hum piece of only somewhat desirable cucumber. Think ice cream cone versus celery stick. Logan was perfectly happy to exchange the token for a cucumber when his pal Liam is getting a cucumber too.
The question is now, how's Logan going to respond to that cucumber when Liam's getting a grape?
What Brosnan finds is more often than not, a capuchin offered the crummy reward after his partner gets the good one says in essence, no way, and refuses to hand back the token.
What we're really testing is, how do you respond when you're the one who gets the lower salary? Not how do you respond when you hear that there's a discrepancy between salaries and the environment? So they don't necessarily have to have an ideal of fairness or an idea of the way the world should work. All they have to care about is that they got less than someone else.
Brosnan sees this work as proof that animals have some of the same complex social rules that humans do. Clive Wynn isn't so sure. Wynn is an animal psychologist at the University of Florida. He says you don't have to invoke ideas like fairness or inequity to explain the capuchin's behavior.
There's an older concept, a more basic concept of frustration that humans share with many other species, the tendency to act up if something they were expecting to receive is not given to them. So if a child is in the habit of receiving a piece of chocolate for completing their homework and then they don't get their piece of chocolate, they may throw a tantrum. And that kind of frustrative behavior is seen in any number of different species and have been shown back in the 1920s in monkeys.
The person who did that monkey work was a psychologist at Yale named Otto Leif Tinkelpaw. I'm not going to say any more about him or his work. I just thought he had such a great name, I wanted to share it. Sarah Brosnan says whether or not you accept terms like fairness or inequity to explain what the capuchins did in her test, she insists you can see unmistakable echoes of human behaviors in her capuchins. Take curiosity. Brosnan says, look at what the capuchins did the first time they saw me in my recording gear. They all came over to have a look.
They're curious about you. You're new. They haven't seen you. They haven't seen a microphone before. So they want to see what it is. Is it going to do anything to them, like give them food, or is it going to be a threat?
Brosnan says curiosity, that desire to explore your world, is key to human culture. We went beyond curiosity about food and threats and began to wonder where we came from and why the stars twinkle in the night. You can also see beginnings of another important human social activity in capuchins, the desire to play, to do things that have no immediate payoff.
You're not acquiring food, you're not mating, you're not defending yourself from a predator.
But saying play is purely social is not to suggest it isn't important. It helps juveniles learn the limits of acceptable behavior in their groups. Brosnan doesn't believe play is a behavior inherited from monkeys in a genetic sense.
But instead is a behavior that all sorts of intelligent, socially living species that live in complex social groups and need to know their ways around them have evolved.
What humans and their big brains bring to the table is an ability to do more with these socially learned behaviors, to be curious about more things in our environment, and extend concepts like fairness and inequity to make more complex societies.
That probably explains why we're building city-states and other species are still in groups of 200.
In other words, we had the human edge. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Now let's move on to oil. The deep-sea well that was spurting oil into the Gulf of Mexico has been capped. But scientists are still trying to figure out how bad the damage is. This week, a map was published that illustrates a plume of oil compounds that extends 22 miles beyond the well. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
For several months now, scientists have been reporting that some oil from BP's blown-out well was staying underwater. Christopher Reddy from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts told a news conference yesterday this was a big surprise.
If you asked me, and I've been studying oil spills for 15 years, whether or not you would see oil and a subsurface, I would say no, doesn't oil float?
That's fascinating, he says, but also troublesome, because if scientists don't know where the oil is, they don't know what harm it might be causing. In June, Reddy and his colleagues from Woods Hole took a research boat to the scene of the spill. They lowered a sensor deep into the water and towed it in a large circle around the blown-out well, looking for particular hydrocarbons that are easy to detect. The sensor picked up a signal southwest of the well in a layer of water 3,000 feet down. Richard Camilli, another researcher from Woods Hole, says they then sent down a new device, a small unmanned submarine with sensors on board called Sentry.
And we had Sentry fly at a constant depth in kind of a zigzag pattern, moving out from the well site, tracking the plume.
The hydrocarbons were highly diluted in the water. They were coming from the well, but they weren't spreading out in all directions. They followed an invisible underwater channel just over a mile wide and 650 feet deep. The researchers tracked that channel southwest for 22 miles until bad weather forced them to stop. They thought they might see microorganisms feasting on those hydrocarbons and breaking them down. Christopher Reddy says they didn't, and he doesn't know why.
Microbes are a lot like teenagers. They work on their own time, their own scale. They do what they want, when they want.
There are many other unknowns. Reddy and his colleagues don't yet know how much of the oil that gushed from the well is in this plume, although they hope to, months from now, when they've analyzed all their water samples. They also don't know how toxic it might be to wildlife. Still, this is the best documented case so far of oil flowing underwater. It was released yesterday by the journal Science.
This report is a big piece of the puzzle.
Stephen Murawski is trying to put the whole puzzle together and figure out where the oil went. He's the science advisor for fisheries for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Spread across the table in his office is a map of the Gulf of Mexico.
We've had up to 7 vessels at a time out here trying to map out the distribution of the underwater feature.
Murawski says more reports are coming about oil in the deep sea around the well. But he'd like to see more scientists working in other areas. On the continental shelf, for instance, the wide, shallow areas closer to shore.
This is the area where fisheries primarily occur. Now, we've got a very vigorous fisheries seafood safety monitoring program, but we need to do more water chemistry up there as well.
Murawski says he's drafting plans to expand such research, gradually painting a more complete picture of where the spilled oil went. Dan Charles, NPR News.
As well as tracking where the oil has gone, scientists are also trying to figure out how the oil is going to affect marine life. As NPR's Christopher Joyce discovered, they need new tools and techniques to get the job done.
Out of sight is not out of mind for marine chemist Dana Wetzel, who works at Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida.
You know, we want to say, yes, everything's all good. You know, the spill has been capped. But the fact is, we don't really know what it means in terms of long-term impacts to birds, marine mammals, fish, shrimp, oysters.
Today, Wetzel and 2 colleagues from the lab are motoring out into the pale blue waters of Sarasota Bay to test a device designed to find whatever oil is meandering through the Gulf. Wetzel calls it a virtual shellfish. It's a membrane, sort of like a strip of plastic inside a metal housing the size of a cell phone. Water flows across the membrane, which collects contaminants like oil.
So we can see what contaminants are in the sediments, what's right above the sediments in the water column, what the clams are accumulating, and then what the spotted eagle rays are accumulating from eating those clams.
Once the device tells scientists how much oil or dispersant is in the water or sediment, scientists can calculate how the contaminants work their way up the food chain as big animals like spotted eagle rays eat littler ones like clams. It's a joint project with Baltimore's National Aquarium and Johns Hopkins University. The plan is to offer the device to researchers in the rest of the Gulf. The team at Moat is doing the hands-on, or flippers-on, part of the research, diving into Sarasota Bay to plant and then retrieve these devices with their contamination fingerprints.
This is a much better approach in understanding the long-term impacts in an area versus simply collecting a water sample or a sediment sample.
That's because it's a big, big ocean. And a sample here and a sample there is hit or miss. These devices are 30-day records of all the contamination that passes through an area. The virtual shellfish is just a tiny part of what marine scientists say is an almost impossible job. Finding where the oil and dispersant have been and are going is hard enough. Then scientists have to figure out what the contaminants may have done or will do. For example,
if a whale dies or if a porpoise dies, you've got a dead body that you can see. But if larvae die, you have no idea what was there in the first place.
That's Richard Pierce, an oceanographer at Moat. When coral or giant tuna, for example, reproduce, they drop uncountable numbers of tiny larvae into the water. No one will know how many of them were or will be wiped out by the oil or dispersant. Some preliminary tests of the dispersant used to break up the oil show that it can kill coral larvae. And marine life that survives exposure could suffer long-term subtle effects that are very hard to measure.
Once it impacts an organism and affects their genes or affects their endocrine system, then the damage is done.
The endocrine system controls things like growth and reproduction by producing and regulating hormones. The damage may not be evident until the next generation of tuna and coral fails to show up in its usual numbers. Moat shark expert Robert Cuter says researchers are going to have to dig harder and spend more money to search for long-term damage.
We're going to have to look much deeper. We're going to be doing more looking inside the shark.
Even if biologists find something amiss, they'll then have to determine whether it was caused by the oil or the dispersant or something else. Kumar Mahadevan, the director at Moat, says it's not as if the Gulf was a terribly healthy place to start with.
This Gulf has been insulted with a whole bunch of environmental issues over the years, from stormwater runoff to sewage runoff to everything under the sun you can think. We've got everything, okay?
Mahadevan says there's still very little money available. Right now in Florida, over 200 scientific institutions are bidding for just $10 million that BP has offered the state. Moreover, he says with the Justice Department and BP preparing for litigation, scientists who take money from either side could be limited in what they can discuss or publish. And what scientists want to study, say the oil's effects on plankton, may not be what lawyers are looking for.
The legal system and the scientific system have different standards, and how this is all going to shake out is very interesting to watch.
And it could be a very long watch. Scientists say it will take years to assess the damage and years of lawsuits to determine who pays for it. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
That's it for this week's edition of On Science. For more science news, be sure to check out our website at npr.org/science. I'm Megan Voss. Thanks for listening.